Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Happy Saturday, folks. It's Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. It's another week, another tumultuous week. I mean, it's been nonstop. Every time I think a week simply can't have more stuff going on, the next week comes along and there's more stuff going on. So I have just loads to cover with you in this show, and I'm going to get right into it. First of all, I'm going to tell you my story, because, you know, I got to start with the story. But here's what we're going to be covering after the story. Number one, you know, there is like all sorts of fragments and disjointed this and that, and news breaking every day, literally several times a day, on the FBI, Russia, CIA. That was just last night at about 6 or 7 o'clock, a New York Times article, which I doubt you've heard about, but I'll bring it to your attention. What I'm going to try and do this morning is to kind of lay this out, should we say, in major point picture. Because, you know, you can get lost in the weeds, which, by the way, is exactly what the Democrats and the press want you to do, right? The more confusing they can make this, the more it'll turn people off, the less they'll pay attention to what's really going on. I mean, it's all part of the alt-left program. But I think I'm going to bring that into context for you. Obama is now implicated, as I told you years ago he would be. We are now learning more about how there were 300 names unmasked illegally by Susan Rice, Ben Rhodes, and Samantha Powers at Obama's behest. Yet there was only one FISA warrant. My surmise on that, by the way, which I've reviewed with you the last 2 weeks, has turned out to be exactly correct. We'll get into that. We've now found out there was a second dossier. We found out that Clinton operatives, longtime operatives, Clintonistas, so to speak, merry members of the corrupt criminal band, were actually responsible for some of the information in these dossiers. And we found out, of course, through the Nunes memo out of the House, of all this nasty stuff we had suspected, that was hammered home by a much more detailed Senate memo, which also included a criminal referral. We have found out that there is a new investigation launched into Uranium One, all sorts of revelations on that. The FBI informant who has all the tapes, the documents, you name it, and who was muzzled by Eric Holder and continued to be muzzled by Loretta Lynch and Obama, and who could not talk about it, has now been testifying to the congressional committees and all sorts of revelations. Why don't we say not revelations, confirmations of what we already knew about the criminal enterprise that is the Clintons, the Democrats, the alt-left, and the Obama administration. So we have lots to cover on that this morning. We're also going to be talking about the economy. Now, I've promised to do this. You know, 3 weeks ago, I believe it was, if you type into the search bar canaries or canaries in the economic mind, you can listen to kind of the first half of this behind-the-scenes economic snapshot for you. Because beneath the ebullience, beneath the merriment, beneath the backslapping on how well things are going, and there are many things going well, there is an underlying cancer in this economy, and yes, the economy of the world. And you need to know about it. So I'm going to be bringing you some more canaries to look for in your economic coal mine. All right. And then I have a couple other little tidbits for you, too, which I'm probably going to start off with. There's all sorts of things going on in immigration. I'm sure that's going to be part of next week's show. I want to tell you that you need to contact your senators, particularly your representative, your House of Representative, a representative also, and you need to tell them to hold firm on this amnesty nonsense, which is going to be taken up for debate next week after this disastrous, I don't know how else to call it, budget bill that was passed. And I'll be talking about in the economic segment and how it affects your personal finances. And it does. Trust me, it does. And that of your children and that of your children's children. So I'm going to expose for you, I'm going to bring into the light some things you need to be thinking about. And some of them are shocking, like the money that you think you have in the bank, you don't. Because it's not your money. Yeah, that's right. When you make a deposit into a bank, particularly the 19 big banks, you know, the two big to fail banks, the banks that were bailed out supposedly in the 08-09 banking crisis, not your dough. It is an asset of the bank, and you simply have an IOU. Not only that, they can take it whenever they want. This is not tinfoil hat stuff. I'm going to give you all the particulars today. So, as far as our story goes, and this is a story, how do I couch this? This is not a true story, but this is a could be true, might be true, maybe will be true story. So you have this great kind of all-American couple. They're living in a suburb or, you know, a rural area outside a big metropolitan city. They are like Mr. and Mrs. America. They believe in the Constitution. They believe in the rule of law. They believe in working hard and getting ahead. They believe in sending their kids to college. They believe in all the American stuff and all the American values. And they bust their butts. They're both working. They do the best they can. You know, their house is, not paid for, but, you know, they've made progress on it. They've been there 10, 15, whatever years. You know, they have a fair amount of assets. They have a little retirement account. I mean, it's Mr. and Mrs. Middle America. And one of the things they want to do, of course, is send their kids to college. I mean, that's a major goal. They want their kids' lives to be better than theirs. And it comes time for the kids to kind of start applying for schools. And about 10 years prior, with some foresight, they had set up some college accounts for the kids. And they had set up a health savings account for themselves. And, I mean, they had pretty much followed the playbook. And the last bit of money they need for the kids, in the equity they had built up in their home over the years and by making faithful payments on their mortgage, they go out and they borrow a HELOC, a second. And they think that the money, of course, is going to go into the kids' college and everything's going to be handy-dandy and the kids are going to have a couple scholarships and maybe a small student loan and life is looking good. And then, one day they go down to the bank. And it's one of the big banks. It's Wells Fargo. It's Bank of America. It's JP Morgan Chase. You know, one of those banks. The 19 too big to fail banks. And they find out that all the money in all their accounts, their retirement account, which they have contributed to for years, the money from the second mortgage on their house, which they had put in along with the rest of the funds they had scraped together and saved over the years for the kids' college fund, the rainy day savings, their checking account, the whole nine yards. They can't withdraw it. And they are told by the bank that your money no longer exists. Instead, you now own, congratulations, 5,000 shares of Wells Fargo or Bank of America or JP Morgan Chase or whatever. And they're in shock disbelief. How could this possibly have occurred? Never in their wildest imagination did they think that playing by the rules, squirreling their money away, saving for all those things important in their lives and their children's lives could be wiped out without their knowledge, without their consent, without notification. Now, I know this sounds like a sad story. And it is. I think this morning I will share enough information with you where you can take certain steps, and I'm not your financial advisor. I'm just a poor hayseed from Wyoming who's bringing you stuff nobody else does, who's giving my rapidly growing audience a heads up and a 1 foot forward and 2 steps ahead of everybody else. That's my job for you. But I think by the time I get done with this show this morning, you will have enough information, and certainly more than 99.99% of Americans out there, unfortunately, to come up with the steps you need to take for you. Because every family and every person and every financial situation and every set of goals and dreams, although they may have similarities, is unique. And that's our story for this morning. Now, before I begin on this increasingly sordid, complicated, but really nasty, really corrupt, really dirty story of the FBI, the DOJ, the CIA, Trump, Clinton, Obama, and a cast of other characters, Obama's alt-left criminal cabal, I'm going to tell you a little something, and I'm going to give you a demonstration. Kind of off topic, but I think you'll get it. Have you noticed that when any of these events have been happening, particularly, I mean, you could see it for years, but particularly over the last month or two, around the Nunes memo, the release of the Nunes memo, now, as of literally yesterday, as of the pending release of the Democratic memo in response to the Nunes memo, as to the Grassley-Lindsey Graham memo from the Senate Subcommittee on Intelligence, or Committee on Intelligence. Look, if you've been watching anything, or you've been listening to anything, or you've been reading anything, somebody is like faxing talking points to every alt-left Democrat out there. And that's basically all Democrats. And I don't mean, listeners, you Democrats who listen to me because you're liberals. I've explained this before. Liberals are Americans with leftist ideas. You believe inherently in the value and the strength of this country. You just differ from conservatives and sometimes from independents in some aspects of them. Alt-left progressives are a whole different breed. And the Democratic Party is alt-left progressive. Don't kid yourself. What's worse is that the press, the mainstream media, is alt-left progressive. And one of the things you may have noticed over the last month or two is that every talking point a Democrat brings up is parroted almost simultaneously, sometimes at the same time, on a multi-level media platform in an all-too-willing and complicit press that then runs with a story and parrots it as if gospel in their paper, on their radio show, on their TV show, whatever. Make no mistake about this. At the same time, I might add, and I haven't gotten to this show, I've been trying to do it for 6 weeks for you, conservative ideas and conservative websites and conservative blogs and conservative news is being purposely tamped down. Absolutely, this is a fact. I mean, I'm going to do this show for you and you'll see it. Tamped down by the big tech giants. Facebook, Google, Yahoo, Huffington Post. I mean, you go right down the line. And their algorithms are raising, in any of your searches, the liberal slash alt-left news. There is a concerted battle right now to misle you, to lie to you, and to affect your perceptions of events by the alt-left and its complicit partner, its wedding cousin, if you will, the alt-left media. And it is despicable. And it's sunk to lows, including the fabrication. I mean, fabrication. Not, oh, I got the story wrong and I'm issuing a correction. I'm talking about out-and-out fabrication of falsehoods by the media, which they then pump out, knowing full well social media will run with it. And 5 million tweets later, they'll publish a tiny retraction which nobody picks up. Let me give you an example. And this example doesn't have to do with the FBI, CIA. We're going to be getting into that. So you may remember, I think it was probably about 2 weeks ago. I've lost track of time with all the stuff going on. And writing the books, by the way, all you readers. And doing the ranching, by the way, all you hay buyers and horse folks that deal with us. You may remember a story about the Democrats screaming about, and the AP and the other mainstream media screaming about these series of raids that ICE performed on convenience stores all around metropolitan areas. You know, how it was unfair targeting and, you know, in violation of the law and blah, 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 blah. Do you remember that? You can Google it up. Just look under ICE raids, dozens of convenience stores. And by the way, it's happened several times. Well, let me tell you, that story, and the AP was kind of the lead left-wing mouthpiece on it. This is an example of what the mainstream media is trying to do to you right now. Because you were told that it was racist, and that it was Trump, and that it was anti-immigrant, and it was this, and it was that, and blah, blah, blah. Well, the facts, Jack, is that, this is almost unbelievable. The raid was conducted by the HSI unit, along with DEA. It was across 4 states. There were 60 people arrested in this huge series of raids. 35 of those have already been indicted by a federal grand jury, including on charges of conspiracy for money laundering, distributing controlled substances, trafficking contraband, etc. Now, here's what the AP and the mainstream media and the wailing Democrats didn't tell you. Of those indicted, let me give you just a few of the names. Muhammad Al-Mutin, a.k.a. Abu Ali, age 35, St. Louis. Rami Al-Mutin, a.k.a. Abu Luay, 33, St. Louis. Mazen Abulsalam, a.k.a. Abu Muhammad, 38, St. Louis. Naja Muhana, a.k.a. Abu Yazan, Fairview, New Jersey. Ferris Muhana, a.k.a. Abu Yamama, age 40, Cliffside Park, New Jersey. Mohamed Khatib and Abu Alamin, both age 36 in Chicago, Illinois. Ismail Mustafa, age 60, in Kankakee, Illinois. Are you kind of getting the picture here? Every single one of the folks indicted, every single one, was Muslim. And every single one, this is every single one, was an illegal alien. And a good number of them have not been indicted yet of the 60. You know, there's 25 remaining with indictments pending because the indictments include links to terror organizations. In addition, some of those that were indicted, and this is a report in TRN, by the way. Let me give you an example. In 2015, authorities in Alabama, because the feds wouldn't do it, this was Obama's time, you know, and Obama, of course, wants as many illegal immigrants as he can get in here. He wants to straddle the company and saddle the, not straddle the company, but saddle the country with as much debt, expense, and division as he could. We'll be getting more into that later tonight, and I've been talking about it for 4 years. I mean, it's nothing new on this show. So that the state authorities had to do this kind of work. And in Alabama, they uncovered, when they were doing this, a massive EBT for terrorism scheme. In other words, Muslim-owned convenience stores were exploiting the U.S. welfare system, the EBT cards, to fund ISIS. I mean, it's tough to make this stuff up, right? All right. That is just one small example of thousands. You can listen to them every day. Of a mainstream media in lockstep with the alt-left, engaged in Alinsky tactics. Deny everything, admit nothing, and distract. Now, that's kind of a good lead-in, I think, to what has occurred this week. This is, once again, this is just this week. As some quick little background, Andrew McCabe, Comey, Brennan at the CIA, perhaps others, certainly their underlings. You'll be recognizing some of the names I'm going to go over this morning, along with Susan Rice and Ben Rhodes, the national security advisors to Obama in the White House. And although he has denied it, you can Google up the videos. One was with Mike Wallace, where Obama, and I'm almost quoting, "I don't talk to the FBI or the DOJ on any pending investigation, period. Guaranteed. No investigation, period." You gotta watch it. This was just a year and a half ago, folks. Just a year and a half ago. Now, never mind that we now have text messages, which are being dribbled out by the Department of Justice. We're going to get into that this morning, too. That one of them says, POTUS, that's Obama, right, President of the United States, POTUS wants to know everything we're doing. That was from Page to Strzok. I happen to think it was about the Hillary Clinton email investigation. The Democrats and the media have tried to spin it, so no, it was about the Trump investigation. Either way, it shows Obama to be a liar and shows him with a finger on the scale of justice. Highly illegal, highly irregular, completely alt-left Alinskyite. I'll tell you why I think it was really about the Clinton deal and that all the uproar over the Democrats trying to cover Obama's tracks and this text and its meaning is about Trump in a moment. We also found out that McCabe and Comey and Rosenstein, the deputy AG, we found out that all these folks, along with others, including Sally Yates, you remember Sally Yates, the acting AG before Sessions got appointed? The AG who basked in the cheers of the left when she refused to implement her boss, that's the President of the United States, his travel ban. The travel ban, by the way, that was ruled, I think, 7-2 by the Supreme Court to be completely legal. That's Sally Yates. So, over the last week, we have found out who signed these FISA warrants, who they were directed at, a guy by the name of Carter Page. We're going to get into that in a moment, too, because Carter Page is not who they were listening to. We have found out that despite all the protestations of the media and all the protestations of the left, that everything they have told us about this entire process is a blatant lie. Black and white falsehood. Remember the difference between a lie and a mistake. A lie is when you know something to not be true and you say it anyway. Or when you know something that would make something you're saying not true and you don't say it. And what we found out is that there were four FISA applications. The first one, and then a renewal every 90 days. The Democrats are trying to obfuscate that issue by saying, well, you couldn't get the renewal if they didn't discover something in the 90 days. Nonsense. That's not the law. And then the Democrats tried to tell us that the dossier was true. Nonsense. Comey admitted it wasn't true. And then they tried to tell us that Christopher Steele, the British MI6, the foreign national paid for by the Clinton campaign, was a reliable source and a good guy and interested in the country. And then we find out, no, he wasn't. In fact, he was so unreliable. He was so bent on breaking rules and laws that the FBI canned him as an informant. Oh, but they did. They forgot to tell the FISA court that. And then we're told, that the dossier wasn't part of the FISA application. Then we find out the dossier was not only part of the FISA application, it was like the spine of the FISA application. And then we're told, oh, there was no fraud by the FBI because it was footnoted in the FISA application. That's right. It was a one-line footnote that said there may have been some political, there may have been some partisan political input into the dossier. A one-line footnote, that's all it said. And then we were told, of course, this was several months ago, that the Clinton campaign had nothing to do with it. And then we find out, oh, you know, they paid $12 million for it through Perkins Coie, the law firm, which then went to Fusion GPS, which then went to Christopher Steele, and then went to the Russians. I mean, I could go on this entire morning with the drivel that they have attempted to feed us. But I think you get the idea, and I think you know most of these points. It's not my job to regurgitate what you already know. So let me tell you what you may not know. And let me try and tie it together for you, which somehow nobody seems to do. First of all, this is what we have learned this week. There is a second dossier. That's right. Not just the first one from Fusion GPS, but now there's a second one. Also being assembled by Christopher Steele. This one seems to have emanated from the State Department. Let's see, who was at the State Department? Oh, that's right, John Kerry. Right. Remember John Kerry, who was jumping up and down and trying to distract us a couple weeks ago? Did he know this news was coming out? Maybe it's just a coincidence. And the State Department, Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, answers to Obama. Oh, yeah, just coincidence. And we find out that this second dossier, and indeed part of the first dossier, we'll call it the Fusion GPS dossier, were not just from the Russians. They were from two Clinton attack dogs who have worked closely and for the Clintons since 1996. And, you know, one of them, Sidney Baby, was the guy who was involved in the incredible and treasonous lie of the Benghazi video. Sidney Blumenthal, Vicious Sid, they call him. And another, I got so many names here, I'll find it here in a moment. And another was a guy who was involved with the Clinton campaign and also had been a Clintonista, an attack dog, a behind-the-scenes purveyor of lies for the Clintons since the late 1990s. And they were feeding stuff to Steele to put in the second dossier. Whether or not some of the stuff in the first, the Fusion GPS dossier, was from them, I guess we'll find out. But that's not all we learned this week. We learned that the Senate Intelligence Committee, that their memo absolutely backs, underscores, highlights, and capitalizes the Nunes memo. And we learned that they have referred Christopher Steele, for criminal prosecution to the DOJ. We learned this week that the Democrats, who have been threatening it, in the prior week, had drafted their own 10-page, quote-unquote, rebuttal memo in the House of Representatives, the Intelligence Committee, to rebut the Nunes memo. Of course, their rebuttal memo has now been completely undermined by this week's events. And we learned that they had a whole bunch of, remember, the Democrats were jumping up and down saying the Nunes memo shouldn't be released because A, it was wrong. B, it discredited the FBI and the DOJ, who would never do anything, and it undermined national security and disclosed sources and uses, and I can go down the list. You heard it all. But we learned that the Democratic memo, which is going to be released in one way, shape, or form by Trump and the National Intelligence Services, was so filled with sources and uses and secret national stuff that it couldn't be released within the five-day time frame, which ended yesterday, Friday. The same people who were lying to us about what the Nunes memo contained and accusing Nunes of disclosing national secrets draft a 10-page memo, his was four, with so many secrets in it that the DOJ is now going over it and redacting it. And I think if you remember, the DOJ is not a friend of Trump's. We learned just last night, this was like 6 o'clock, and I'm sure you're going to hear more about it over the weekend, that the intelligence agencies of the United States, the spies, American spies, made a deal with a Russian, quote-unquote, informant to pay him $1 million for dirt on Donald Trump. And I don't mean espionage dirt. I don't mean Russian collusion dirt. I mean dirt, sex dirt, nasty dirt, personal in-your-face, want-to-hurt-you, take-you-down dirt. But it gets better. It gets better. Yeah, I don't know how it could get better, but it gets better. Our intelligence folks, our spies, actually took $100,000 of our taxpayer money, converted it to cash, put it in a briefcase, and left it in a hotel room in Moscow as the down payment on this $1 million. Needless to say, the clever Russian quote-unquote informant absconded with the money and they got nothing. Now here's the punchline to this story. All this occurred in 2017. In other words, folks, all this occurred while Donald Trump was the president of the United States, not during the campaign. We have American spies from the shadow government, from the deep state, I'm sure answering to some of the people that we're going to be further discussing here in this segment of the show, using taxpayer money to dig up personal dirt having nothing to do with national security, Russian collusion, or anything else on a then-sitting president of the United States who is their boss. But there's no deep state, folks. The media and the Dems tell us there's no deep state, there's no shadow government. Our FBI and DOJ would never do that. You know what else we learned? Oh, my. We learned that in addition to this series of outrageous stuff, that Nunes memo and the Grassley Graham memo out of the Senate, even though we were told by the mainstream media they were wrong and they were false and they were lies and the blah, 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 da, 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 the usual yada yada of the left. We learned that 8 top-ranking people have resigned, been pushed out, or been knocked down at the FBI and DOJ in the last week, including literally the top 3 people other than Ray, the director at the FBI, the general counsel. And we learned that just in the last day, folks, which happens to be one day after the Senate Intelligence Committee memo I've been speaking of, the one that refers Steele for criminal prosecution, that backs to the hilt and emphasizes and gives more detail on the Nunes memo, all of which were debunked by the were attempted to be debunked by the Democrats and the press. One day after that memo is unredacted, there are five resignations of top-level people at the DOJ and the FBI. It just must be a coincidence. And you probably haven't heard much, if anything, of this. But, and by the way, there's more coming. So, Rachel Bond, she's the number three at the Department of Justice, an Obama appointee. How interesting is that? And do you know what she was involved with? Oh, yeah, the Hillary Clinton email investigation. She resigned because she's going to go into private practice. And David Loftman, another high up at the DOJ, I think he's number six or seven. And you know what he was involved with? Oh, the Clinton email investigation. And then Josh Campbell, by the way, you're going to see an interesting little thing here I'm going to bring to your attention. Josh Campbell, a high up in the FBI. He was like Comey's press guy. You know, Comey is like his hero. He resigned, and he's going to NBC, MSNBC, to be a paid commentator, quote, to defend the FBI, unquote. In fact, you'll see under the treason articles a copy. I don't know where they got it, but they got a copy of the announcement he sent out to all his little buddies, his deep state buddies at the FBI, about his farewell party. You ought to read it. It'll make you puke. And then Sally Yates. Sally Yates. Remember when she quit? Well, now her assistant, who was fulfilling her responsibilities, has also quit. Michael Cart, and I may have his last name wrong, excuse me, he was the public affairs officer for Mr. Comey. He quit yesterday. Huh. Wow. And then we find out that John Brennan, and I've told you a lot about John Brennan, Obama's political pick for the CIA, a rabid hate Trumper, a huge globalist, converted to Islam in Riyadh in 2009, running the CIA. I mean, boy, that gives you, that makes you feel good. Brennan, Brennan is going to work as a commentator at CNN. Look, do you see right in front of your eyes, we've gone from the Democrats being supported by the media, the Democrats coming up with the talking points, which the media then turns into false stories, to the Democrats and the deep state now getting on board at the media to pound away at the airwaves with their untrue gospel. This is like in the last 72 hours. You have any idea what's coming? I mean, this is the tip of the iceberg. You can hear the suck of air as a swamp begins to drain. And let me tell you, all these swamp creatures, resignations, not good enough. None of them should get any pay. None of them should get any retirement or other benefits. All of them should be investigated. And those that are culpable, which I personally believe is all of them, should be indicted, tried, and justice meted out. This is the battle for the Republic. Make no mistake about it. What you see playing out right now is the battle for the heart of America. The Steele and Grassley memo, now unredacted, and causing all these huge waves, because it substantiated the Nunes memo, which everybody was telling us was a bunch of nonsense, says in part, quote, "It is troubling enough that the Clinton campaign funded Mr. Steele's work, but that these Clinton associates," that's Blumenthal and this other guy, Rory something, "were feeding Mr. Steele allegations raises additional concerns about his credibility." By the way, the Senate committee, this is kind of an interesting sidelight, wanted to get their memo out shortly after the Nunes memo, which, if you remember, was a week ago Friday. Unlike Nunes, they sent it to the DOJ and the FBI to review. And what they got back, I originally had the producers put that up on the website. I don't think it's there now. I think the unredacted memo is right underneath the audio bar. If you're not AM and you're listening on podcast, you can read the Grassley memo. But when they got it back, it was, and I saw it, at least 70% of that memo had been blacked out. And do you know what had been blacked out? By the watchdogs looking out for national security interests at the DOJ and the FBI deep state. Oh, yeah. All the names of all the players who did the bad deeds. Nothing to do with national security. Nothing to do with sources and uses. All to do with CYA. Cover your ass. On our tax dollar. Grassley was so pissed off when he got back the memo that he wanted to release to the public, and which the public deserves, and which the public owns, and the public pays for. Quote, "Seeking transparency and cooperation should not be this challenging. The government should not be blotting out information that it admits isn't secret, and it should not take dramatic steps by Congress and the White House to get answers that the American people are demanding. There are still many questions that can only be answered by complete transparency. That means declassifying as much of the underlying documents as possible." Amen. Amen. Remember what I think. I think it all ought to be released, folks. I want to see the four FISA applications, the original and the renewals. I want to see everything that was attached to them. I want the transcripts of the pleadings by the crooked DOJ attorneys and others. I've told you what I think. Everything needs to be released. The whole nine yards. And I stick by it. And you know what? Everything means a lot of stuff we don't even know yet. I mean, we don't even know yet. The press, by the way, is going berserk over all this stuff. You may have heard about the so-called scandals in the White House yesterday. Some poor, and I guess very accomplished and very competent guy left the White House, I mean resigned immediately, because his two ex-wives accused him of battery. I don't know if it's true. I don't know if it's not true. And then there was a second guy by the name of Sorensen, who also kind of left abruptly yesterday, same cloud. You know, it's... ladies, do you understand what the left is doing with your hashtag MeToo movement? Like everything else the left touches, they're weaponizing it. Weaponizing it. Just as Obama, unquestionably, without a doubt, there's not a vestige of doubt, weaponized the government, the EPA, against businesses and energy, the IRS against conservatives, the DOJ against his political enemies and his enemies in the press, like Rosen, and then lied about it, of course, and the DOJ, the FBI, and the CIA against Trump and the Republicans. And I can give you other examples. Those are the four that you're most familiar with. So too does the left weaponize their ideology. That's why when they can't respond with coherent thought, you're called a racist, a xenophobe, a homophobe, an ignoramus, and worse. It's what they do. In the wake of these memos coming out, every commentator on mainstream media, and I'm telling you, every commentator, type in the words memo nothing burger and just watch them all. Watch them all. Every talking head called the memos a nothing burger. By the way, many of them made the pronouncement before ever seeing it. William Jacobson of Legal Insurrection wrote a little article. A key part of the memo was that the FBI, this is the Fusion GPS memo, and the FISA warrant, the application for the FISA warrant, was that the FBI utilized a Yahoo News report to back up the Steele, that's the Fusion GPS dossier. But the Yahoo News report information was fed to Yahoo by Fusion GPS. So it was, and I quote, completely circular buttressing, as both documents had the same source, unquote. However, this was not pointed out to the FISA courts, folks, just as a side note. One of the things which I brought up in previous shows is how could there only be one FISA warrant, but there were 300 names unmasked by Rhodes, Rice, and Samantha Powers, all in the year of the campaign. This is 2016. I believe it's 9 times more, 14, I mean, it's some astronomical multiple of all names released in any other year, and a multiple, an exponential multiple of all names that were unmasked in the previous 7 years. Where did those names come from? They certainly couldn't come from one FISA warrant on Carter Page. But you know what else we learned this week? Yeah, they did. They did. Because every person that Carter Page communicated with, and it appears, we're waiting for confirmation on this, the people who communicated with the people that Carter Page communicated with were surveilled. Their emails, their phone calls, the whole nine yards. That's where all the transcripts came from that had the names in them, 300 of them, that were unmasked by Obama and Obama's cabal. Another little tidbit this morning. And then we have Roll Call newspaper, the left-wing rag, saying that the Nunes memo would weaken FISA. Okay, whatever. And then we have MSNBC saying that it's an attack on the FBI and it's an attack on our institutions. As you can tell, the attack was fake because, you know, half the institutions are resigning right now, running for the hills and hiring lawyers. Must have been a really untrue memo, huh? Some of the other things we learned this week, which would be better. Let me find this text. Oh, here we go. So the press and the Democrats are trying to tell us that this Peter Strzok text message, which between Peter Strzok and Linda Page, that the text message from Page saying that POTUS wants to know everything we're doing, which came in the first part of September 2016. They're trying to tell us it had nothing to do with Hillary Clinton's emails because the Hillary Clinton case was closed. Now, I will point out that the Hillary Clinton case was never really opened. That Comey, quote-unquote, closed the case, if you remember, in July 5th to be exact, in his unbelievable 13.5-minute indictment and then exoneration. And we also know, of course, the memo that he read from had been entirely rewritten, number one, to omit Obama's name. I told you about that last week. As you know from many other news sources, to change the words grossly negligent, which means a crime, to extremely careless, which is a technicality to kind of get you out of the crime, and on and on. I'm not going to repeat all that stuff here. But we learned this week, and I want you to put two and two together here. We learned this week that the reason that, let me back up. As you know, hundreds of thousands of emails, thousands of them classified, were found on Anthony Weiner, the pervert's computer. And as you know, he was married to Uma Abedin, Clinton's right-hand gal for many years, and by the way, alt-left and Islamist. And as you know, both Abedin and Cheryl Mills, who was complicit in all this, that was Hillary Clinton's chief of staff, lied to the FBI concerning the existence of these emails and other matters, and were complicit in the destruction of evidence, the 33,000 emails from Hillary's server, the bashing of BlackBerrys with hammers, you name it. And as you know, Comey and the FBI gave them immunity. We'll see if that stands up or not. But here's what you don't know, because we just learned it this week. McCabe, crook that he was, knew about these emails and had them almost a month, as far as we know. It could have been longer. Prior to Comey's second big press conference, which if you remember was like 2 weeks before the election, which said, oh, we have to reopen the investigation because we have all these emails, hundreds of thousands. And we find out that the only reason Comey, who was complicit, we have found out this week, in hiding these emails from the public, their very existence in their supposed Hillary Clinton investigation. The emails, by the way, were reviewed, we learned this week, because of his own text messages, by Peter Strzok. Oh, my, what a circular wagon we pull. So Strzok, they find out about the emails because the New York field office of the FBI finds them on Wiener's laptop. So it was like in the FBI records, so they had to do something. So Strzok goes out there, and if you read his text messages, it says that it's going to take him 3 weeks. And then we find out that McCabe gets the emails, we presume from Strzok, after Strzok's, by his own admission, 3 weeks, and sits on them, hides them for a month. And we believe with Comey's full knowledge. And now we find out this week that the only reason Comey brought this out at all was to cover everybody's ass. Because the New York field office was so pissed off that nothing was being done over this blatant series of felonies, these blatant breaches of the Espionage Act, which they had uncovered, and that it was all being swept under the carpet by the crooks at the upper levels of the Washington FBI, the main, you know, the headquarters, the top cheeses, the top moldy cheeses, that they leaked to the New York papers. And Comey and McCabe and whoever else knew, they probably got a call from a reporter, a good reporter, trying to follow up and verify. They hastily called this press conference 2 weeks before the election to say, oh, we've just discovered, yeah, right, just discovered, these emails, and we're going to have to reopen the investigation. It's going to take a while. And then, of course, 2 days later, oh, we've looked at all the emails. There's nothing to see here. Remember all that? And the Democrats are trying to tell us that Obama's wanting to, quote, know everything that's going on, everything you're doing, i.e. the FBI is doing, unquote, command sometime in the first part of September, communicated by Strzok and Page via their text messages, was okay because it was about Trump and this Russia collusion and the undermining of our democracy by Trump and Russia. No, folks. You mark my words. When all this comes out, this was Barack Obama inquiring into the discovered emails on Uma Abedin's server. And he was inquiring for three reasons. Number one, we have also learned in the past several weeks, I talked about in last week's show, that Barack Obama, despite lying through his teeth in numerous television interviews, that he didn't know anything about it, that he read about it in the press, and blah, 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 that Barack Obama was communicating under an alias, no less. In other words, he was trying to hide it with Hillary Clinton. And therefore, Barack Obama committed a felony under the Espionage Act. So he was concerned with, yeah, gee, cover his ass. And the other reason he was concerned was he didn't want Trump to be president. And the other reason he was concerned was he didn't want Hillary, baby, to get a black eye. It's all tied in together. Let me give you the real timeline of what happened here, which nobody else has put together. We'll see if I'm right. Sometime in August, we'll find out, is when the field office, go back and look at the Wiener articles, which I did. The FBI raided all of Wiener's stuff, took all his stuff sometime in June, July, early August. I can't tell you the exact date. I didn't have time to look at every article, but it was in that time frame. It would seem to me that shortly thereafter, a great New York FBI office, and they are, discovered all this classified material on, of all laptops, wieners. And discovered that Aberdeen had put them there. And that somehow they had come from Hillary and the State Department. And who knows, maybe there was Obama emails in there. I wouldn't doubt it. And the New York office calls Washington. And Washington sends out, oh yeah, Peter Strzok. Take a look at the date of Peter Strzok's text, which came out this week. And trust me, there'll be more texts coming out. Look at what he says. It's going to take him 3 weeks to review this stuff. And then look at what we found out last week, which is that McCabe sat on these emails for at least a month. I'm telling you that Barack Obama had been alerted, either by friends in the press, higher ups in the FBI because of the alert from the New York field office. We're going to find this out, because this is a snowball that's gathering steam. And he wanted to know what was happening with the Hillary investigation, which he thought was over and done with because of his collusion and corruption with Comey, McCabe, Clinton, Bill Clinton, Loretta Lynch, and others. You mark my words. All trails lead back to Barack Obama, which is what the left is so concerned about, I might add. You know, the FBI text messages, which kind of gives you the whole feel of this. Exactly. This is Page to Strzok. Quote, POTUS wants to know everything we're doing, unquote. All right. Listen, I can go on and on and on here. I will tell you that my theory of not just reporting, not just supporting, not just bolstering, but actual corrupt collusion between the mainstream media and the alt-left really became, it's something that I've felt. It's something that all the dots lead to. It's something which has been more and more pronounced over the past months. But Mike Wallace, who I think is one of the best interviewers in journalism, and he's absolutely, he'll tear your throat out, doesn't matter whether you're left, right, up, down, gay, straight, man, woman, it doesn't matter. He is a terrific interviewer. He interviewed last Sunday Leon Panetta, who is a Democrat, who, if you remember, worked for a while for Obama, appointed by Obama at the CIA. And he's worked in other administrations also. And normally, you know, he's kind of reasonable. But after listening to 3 days of all the Democratic talking points and the left-wing media echo chamber, he sat there and basically repeated all the talking points, including the ones which have been debunked for years. One of the things he said was 17 agencies have concluded there was Russian. No, that was debunked 9 months ago, Leon. There were never 17 agencies. Made up story. There were three agencies. For those of you on the left who listen to me because you hate me, Google up Mr. Clapper, the National Security Director at the time, the guy who was the intermediary between CIA and POTUS, Mr. Obama. Clapper is very clear. There are only three agencies that issued the report on Russian collusion, and they found no evidence of anything to do between Trump and Russia. So that was a talking point which kind of riveted my attention on this Panetta interview. Then he said, we need to talk to the FISA judge. Really? Since when do you get the hall judge in to talk about anything unless there's corruption by the judge? There was no corruption by this FISA court that we are even remotely aware of. The FISA court can only rule on what the FISA court is given. Garbage in, garbage out. So talk to the judge. This is a left-wing mainstream media talking point about let's go talk to the judge because they know you can't go talk to the judge. Oh, and then he said that this whole thing about the FBI, which, of course, now we know with resignations and hirings of counsel and all that stuff like an hourly occurrence, that, you know, this was totally unwarranted and that it was interfering with their ability to protect us from terror, blah, 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 blah. I found it just absolute. It was like the icing on the cake of my supposition. It was the period at the end of my sentence, as Mr. Obama would like to say, guaranteed, period. Hey, guaranteed, period, I'm lying like a rug. You mean, Barry. All right. This is going to bring us to our next segment. And I think that you're going to find it fascinating. I mean, fascinating. And this is our segment on the economy and what it means to you. And while I'm going through the segment, I want you to keep in mind the story I gave you to start off the show. The story that I told you was not yet true, but could be. Keep that in mind as I go through this for you, because I don't think anybody else in media, period, thank you, Barry, I'm using your word, period, has done this for you. Sure, you can find bits and pieces of this information hither, yither, and yon, and the talking heads on, you know, Bloomberg and wherever. But nobody has tied it together like I'm going to tie it for you together this morning. And it's a scary picture. It's not a panic picture. I am by no means trying to say that what's going on in the economy is bad. I am trying to bring your attention to canaries in your economic coal mine, in addition to those I brought to your attention in the show 3 weeks ago. This is about your financial security. This is about the safety and security of you, your family, your children, and your children's children. And that story I told you at the beginning of the show, I think this is the exact right time to do it because of the terrible budget deal that was passed literally yesterday by the Senate and the House. A 2-year budget deal, which everybody's congratulating themselves on. But now, let me tell you, relative to this economy, relative to this budget bill, and relative to what it means to you individually and your family, the rest of the story. To start this segment on stuff you don't know and you really, really, really need to know, I'm going to give you just a little historical foundation. I'm going to make it brief, because I've talked about all this stuff in previous shows years ago. So the mortgage crisis, which precipitated the Great Recession, you know, 07, particularly 08, 09, 10, housing prices cratered, I mean, you remember. It was precipitated by a bust in mortgages and a bust in things called derivatives. Now, let's step back, because all that's going to come into the equation later. Jimmy Carter, poor Jimmy, he did a deal called the Community Reinvestment Act. And this mandated, and it started with Franklin Savings in Philadelphia, et cetera, in a big lawsuit by the left, by the way, by the left. And it mandated that banks and SNLs put a percentage of their portfolio into things which would reinvest in their communities. And obviously, the communities which were targeted for reinvestment were the poorer communities around the country. The Community Reinvestment Act was kind of reiterated, highlighted, and enhanced by Bill Clinton. And that was because, and you'll remember, you'll know these names, Maxine Waters, that's right, the same crazy Maxine Waters as today, you know, impeach 45, Maxine Waters, Barney Frank, you might remember him, and Chris Dodd, the crook from Connecticut. They pushed Clinton to expand the Community Reinvestment Act to include mortgages. And of course, the banks, who were mandated, otherwise they would pay big fines, to pump 10% or whatever it was of their portfolio back into these poor communities, jumped on the chance to do mortgage lending because they kind of knew that. The problem was is that these communities didn't have a whole bunch of people that could qualify for loans. They didn't have down payments. They didn't have credit reports. Some of them didn't even have jobs. They didn't have the income to support the mortgages. So the banks put together all sorts of different weird mortgages. They became known as subprime mortgages. I'm giving you a synopsis here. And then those mortgages were bundled in SBOs and MBOs, mortgage-backed obligations. The local banks would bundle them into tranches of like 10 or 20 million. And then the bigger banks would bundle them in 100 million, 200 million. And finally, they'd go to the really big banks, you know, those 19 too-big-to-fail banks, and to the investment bankers on Wall Street, who made a killing. This is where the private sector exacerbated this government mess. And they took all these mortgage-backed securities. These, at that point, there were hundreds of billions in each of these packages. And they sliced and diced them. They tranched them into different grades of securities. Really good credit was like an A grade. Really bad credit was like an F grade. And then they sold these pieces of mortgages, these pieces of mortgage-backed obligations to banks and insurance companies and you name it the world over. And of course, they got lower rates for the A securities. You know, somebody who could do more than fog a mirror, had a job and a credit report. And they didn't get as much for the F securities. But all these poison pills circulated throughout the entire Western world's financial system and throughout the financial system of the United States. And then, of course, it all came crashing down. And this is really where this incredible tale of you don't have any money, literally, you don't have any money begins. Let me step back. There are countries the world over where this, not exactly alike, but the same general concepts have been employed by governments. You have Cyprus, you have Greece, you have New Zealand, you have Ireland, where government manipulation and creation of money out of thin air for supposed social causes, but really just to buy the votes of constituents to stay in power, has resulted in catastrophe. You have examples right here in the United States with states, California, Illinois, New York. I told you a little bit last week about what was going on in Illinois. The state is broke. It literally could not pay, as of a couple months ago, I did a whole show on it, it could not pay its $16 billion in current operating expenses. You can't be more than broke. You can't be more broke than that as a government entity. Unless, of course, you're Venezuela, which we'll talk about here in just a moment. California. California. California is totally broke, folks. Totally broke. And California, like Illinois, does the same thing. In other words, they create the same problem by doing the same mistake and then try and rectify or cover over or kick the can down the road of the mistake by compounding the error. In Illinois, one out of every 4.3 there's one person leaving every 4.3 minutes. That's how bad it is. Because the state is borrowing. That's right, borrowing. Remember that word. You're going to hear a lot about it here in the next 20 minutes. Is borrowing $105 billion or so. Oh, excuse me, $107 billion. I wouldn't want to slight them, you know. $107 billion, for which they're paying exorbitant rates because their credit is so bad because they're broke. You know, I think I gave you the example last week of you're a household, you have five credit cards, they're maxed out, you're paying 20% on them, so to solve the problem, you go out and get another $5,000 credit card at 30%. Now, you and I know, even though we're just, you know, we're just bubbas, we're just the red state folks who don't know squat. We are, as Peter Strzok termed us in his texts, which were uncovered this week, ignorant hillbillies. We are deplorables, as Hillary Clinton would like to say. And we are the bitter clingers, as Barry would call us. But, you know, because we don't know this stuff. We don't know that if you have five maxed out credit cards at 20%, taking out another credit card at 30% ain't going to save your butt. We don't know that. Obviously, Illinois doesn't know that either. California, I mean, that's Illinois. California has the highest, now has the highest poverty rate in the country. One in five people in California, folks, are living in poverty. That's 20%. In fact, of all the welfare paid in the entire United States, 33%, fully one-third of all welfare payments are made to people in California. The state itself, never mind the feds, spent $958 billion. This is almost $1 trillion, folks, $958 billion, on welfare programs between 1992 and 2015. By the way, take those numbers I just gave you and understand that California, though the most populous state, is only 12% of the population of the United States. A state that has 12% of the population consumes 33% of all welfare payments, and 20% of that 12% of the population of the United States is in poverty. 30% of American citizens in California are receiving means-tested welfare. 30% of United States citizens living in California. But you'll love this. 55% of illegal aliens or immigrant families which are not United States citizens. 55% of those people in California are receiving welfare. Basically, the state is handing over tons of cash, your cash, my cash, California residence tax to foreign nationals. And what's similar in all this? What's similar in Illinois, who suffers much the same plight? What's similar in this California thing, you know, these social justice warriors who are intent on spending your money? What's similar to the folks in Greece, the government in Greece, where you have a 30-hour work week, you know, paid everything, blah, 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 and they're totally broke? Cyprus, Ireland, before it got its caca together 10 years ago, and a host of other places. What's similar, folks, is that all of this money is being spent for social programs that produce nothing, that create nothing, that have no tangible or investment value, and therefore on which you will never get a return. And you know, in the end, if you keep spending money and you don't get a return on it, whether it's human production and productivity, whether it's human advancement, whether it's infrastructure, whatever it happens to be, if you spend money with no return, I don't care who you are, whether you are the Bank of America, Enron, gee, that name ring a bell, GE, that name ring a bell, they're in the tank, or the United States of America, you are going to go broke. Ask California, they're broke. Ask Illinois, they're broke. Ask New York and Connecticut, they're just about broke. All for the same reasons and the same patterns. And all these places, I'm going to give you the example here of Venezuela, which I started on last week. All these places try and paper over the problem. They try and put a symptomatic Band-Aid on a bleeding juggler, thinking that, you know, somehow something's going to change and everything's going to be all right. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's like denying gravity. It's like looking me in the eye as a Wyoming rancher and telling me water runs uphill. Wrong. It's just wrong. Beep. New contestant. So bottom line is, Americans in California are mostly jobless. Housing prices are so high that nobody can afford a house. And in fact, The cost of housing is one of the things which is contributing to poverty. And why does housing cost so much other than the normal market supply and demand? Because of California's environmental regulations. Gee, another social project gone awry, producing no returns and costing money, limitless money, which has a finite end. You know, legislative director, he's a Democrat, Sean Moore, and senior economic advisor Marcus Stanley. This is the top senior economic guy in California. They wrote a check. Freudian slip. They wrote a memo. They can't write a check. They don't have any money. Wrote a memorandum to Senator Boxer, you know, that crazy liberal babe from California. One of them. Anyway, there's a bunch of crazy liberal babes from California in Congress. Quote, the estimate that in 2009, California received $1.45 in federal expenditures for each dollar paid in taxes is conservative and likely to be an underestimate. Now, I want you to think about that for a moment. California got $1.45 in federal expenditures for each dollar California collectively paid back to the federal government. In other words, you and me are supporting California to the tune of 45 cents on the tax dollar. Do you understand why I jumped up and down and praised the hell out of the provisions in Trump's tax law that finally started to equalize things between this subsidy that you and I, the Bubbas, are given to the rich dudes who vote for the liberal folks who have broken their states in California, New York, Illinois, Connecticut, etc.? This is just another glaring in-your-face example. And what did California do? It did the same. It's doing the same thing that Illinois did. It is borrowing more money at higher rates because its credit sucks because of bad decisions in the past. Then it's compounding those decisions. And not only is it compounding those decisions, it's also, like Illinois, Illinois has a 34% income tax rate rise, state income tax. It's raising income taxes on the fewer and fewer Californians who are working and paying taxes. The result is, that's right, same as Illinois, people are leaving California in droves, like droves. In fact, over the last 10 years, the San Francisco area, one of the most expensive in California, has lost more population than at any point in its history, and that includes the San Francisco fire on a percentage basis. I mean, that ought to tell you something. It ought to tell the folks in California something. But, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but as we say on the ranch, you can't make him drink. You certainly can't. Now, Venezuela. Let's talk about a sovereign nation. I'm just going to pick on them tonight. Although I could, this morning, I could pick on many, but we're gonna do poor Venezuela. So Venezuela has now been. Why don't we say they have their social experiment, their socialistic experiment, with the two guys at the top, Chavez, who's dead, and the gentleman who took over for him, Maduro, putting away billions in their Swiss bank accounts. Venezuela has gone from a thriving, and vibrant and coming, emerging economy. I mean, it was really one of the brighter lights in South America just 15 years ago. And now, 75% of the adult population are in such dire need of food that they lost an average of 19 pounds each last year. 82% of Venezuelan households live in poverty. The minimum wage, even though it's been raised seven times, is $1.81 or $1.80. I mean, does it really matter? $1.81 or $1.83 per day. That's per day. Basically, you are working for one penny And, you know, I it's $1.83 a week, folks. I mean, it's almost like you can't believe these numbers. $1.83 a week, which comes out to about 1 penny per hour minimum wage if you're a minimum wage worker in Venezuela. 1 penny, that's penny, cent, you know, the copper thing with a Lincoln head on it, per hour. To say the situation is dire is an understatement. By the way, when Chavez came to power, he disarmed the people in Venezuela, saying that it was about their safety and to reduce crime and etc. So now the people of Venezuela are facing a military with guns and they have none. It's kind of tough to overthrow a socialistic tyrant if you're not armed. Now, let's see, what does the left want to do in America? Oh, that's right, they want to take our guns. Must be a coincidence. Okay. Estimated 15% of the population gets most of their food daily from edible scraps they find in garbage bins. I mean, you can't, it's unbelievable. They're virtually out of medications. They do not have the money to sterilize operating rooms in their hospitals. If you have an operation down there, the chances are highly likely there will be no anesthesia. They don't even have the money to buy equipment which sterilizes medical instruments. Do you have an idea how bad this is? And you know how this all started? Yeah, that's right, with social programs that they didn't have the money to pay for. And slowly the working class either, you know, perished, famished, were locked up, or left. It's the same situation that you are seeing evolve in Illinois, California, and other states. And the reason I'm giving you this background, because it leads right into where I'm going with this segment. So in 2008, when all this mortgage stuff was coming down in the United States, i.e. another failed social program that had no economic foundation, that created money from nothing, and that produced nothing, i.e. subprime mortgages, failed. And to get us out of the hole that they had created, the government started to print money. And with that money, it bought our own debt. In other words, the United States Treasury would issue $200 million in Treasury bonds at XYZ percent. And the Federal Reserve, supposedly independent, we all know it's part of the government, would turn around and buy those bonds and add them to their balance sheet. Their balance sheet, which was a couple hundred million, give or take, I mean, the number isn't important, swelled over the last 10 years to over $4 trillion. That is $4 trillion, almost $5 trillion, that was created out of thin air, folks. Thin air. Literally, the United States Treasury printed the money, the Fed claimed it, the Fed used it to buy our own debt. That's like, you know, your left hand moving a quarter to your right hand, except that the quarter doesn't exist. The Fed determined about 6 months ago to start unwinding this. This is called quantitative easing. You can listen to detailed shows on quantitative easing and this whole economic experiment that is doomed to failure in previous shows of mine going back several years. And what they're doing now is they are trying to get their balance sheet, that is the balance sheet of their own debt. I mean, that's really what it is. You know, they buy the debt on one hand and call it an asset on the other. They're trying to get that balance sheet down, which means that instead of pumping money into the economy by buying treasury bonds and holding them on their balance sheet, they are now allowing bonds to mature and not repurchasing them. You know, Treasury bonds have terms. There's 1 and 2 and 3 and whatever years. And that is where they used to be pumping up to $40 billion a month into the economy, starting back there in 08 and 09. That is now reversed. And they've been taking about $10 billion a month out of the economy, which is going to accelerate to $20 billion a month, and then accelerate again. In fact, most economists figure, by listening to, you know, what the Fed says, that $480 billion will be taken out of the cash flow of this economy between now and next October. Remember, October is the fiscal year of the United States government. And by the way, I'm trying really hard not to be wonkish in all this stuff. I'm giving you stratospheric level things, and they're all coming to a absolutely flabbergasting conclusion. Believe me, you will not believe how this segment ends. You will shake your head and think I am full of caca, and I'm not. So 2018, this happens to be out of one of Porter Stansberry's letters. Quote, because of the Fed's actions, it's highly likely that 2018 will see one of these rare inversions between short and long-term rates, an inverted yield curve, which is going to be the final, quote, get out of the pool, unquote, warning before the storm. Now, I talked a little bit about that as a canary in the coal, the canary in the economic mine several shows ago. And I think that you're seeing the beginnings of doubt, of hesitation, of, oh my God, where are we at in this up and down in the stock market? And I'm not saying the stock market's going to crash tomorrow or anything like that. In fact, I'm not a stock guy. I've told you that a million times. My personal opinion, I could be totally wrong, I'm not an expert at this, is that you're seeing what's called a solidifying high, and you need a market correction of 10% or more to go higher. But look, folks, the stock market and investments like it are now in the realm of the game of musical chairs. You don't want to be the one standing when the music stops. And when the music stops, you're going to see all sorts of things happen. Number one, they've started, and that is trade protection. And by the way, I happen to be a fan of tariffs on goods from countries who are cheating on trade deals like China and India and others. Now, it didn't get a lot of fanfare in the press, but Trump has already started slapping tariffs on China just in the last month or so. He started with washing machines, which, by the way, a number of companies try and import into the United States, and solar panels. And he's doing that to try and bolster manufacturing in the United States of those types of commodities. And I agree with that. But when you start slapping tariffs on other countries' goods, there is a reaction. And China's reaction, I talked about this just a little bit 2 weeks ago, China's reaction is going to be they are going to buy less United States Treasury securities. They hold, give or take, $800 billion, trillion, who cares? It's a lot of dough. Now, and they are going to buy less, and they are not going to renew. Remember, you already have the Federal Reserve starting that, should we say, reversal of quantitative easing. And now you have the high likelihood that China, as partial retaliation for the tariffs, they're going to be doing their own kind of reverse United States securities transactions. In other words, letting bonds mature and not renewing them and not buying anything new or tailoring it way down. This is going to take more money out of the economy. I mean, this is just math. Which brings us to the big banks. Keep all these things in your mind if you can. That brings us to the big banks. Now, these big banks were some of them were criminal, but of course, Eric Holder and Obama didn't prosecute them because they got a lot of campaign contributions. Others were just stupid, and others were just greedy, and some were a combination of all. But the 19 largest banks in the United States, which are among the largest financial institutions in the world, these banks were right in the thick of the action on these derivatives I was telling you about just a few minutes ago that were all backed by pieces of mortgage-backed obligations. Mortgage bonds, if you will, that were split into many different pieces and sold everywhere. And these things are called derivatives. When you take an asset in its simplest terms and you break it into pieces or you create kind of sub-pieces, it's a derivative. And derivatives are highly risky. Let me underline that. Highly risky. If you don't think so, just look at what happened in 08 and 09. You almost had the Bank of England, Deutsche Bank, and a whole bunch of other huge international banks go down the toilet. You had AIG, which had insured a lot of these derivative trades, need $16 billion from the federal government to stay afloat, and I can go on down the list. Because derivatives, when they come back at you, they boomerang with a vengeance and with exponential nastiness. And it's a chain reaction. One set of derivatives goes bad. It affects the balance sheet of the institution, bank, whatever, holding them. The banks that are holding collateral of the bank that's in trouble call the collateral because Bank A, the borrower bank, its derivatives, its collateral, have gone down in value. Because, you know, when Big Bank A lends to Big Bank B, if Big Bank B puts up derivatives as collateral, it's no different than you borrowing money from your local banker for your car. If your local banker thinks you're in trouble and you're not going to pay, he's going to come take the car. Well, Bank B is going to come take Bank A. I mean, or they're going to take Bank A's collateral, the derivatives. Anyway, that's what kind of happened in 2008-2009, and that is why Lehman Brothers collapsed. I don't know if you know that or not, but that is the reason they collapsed, and it was an overnight collapse. This is one of the eight largest investment banks in the world. In one night, they got wiped out because the banks who had loaned them operating capital swooped in and took the derivatives that Lehman Brothers had put up as collateral. Now, that didn't help the big banks. They were all broke. Let me emphasize this. Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Chase Manhattan, all those big banks, Citicorp, were broke, folks. They weren't like in trouble and needed help. They were done, finished, over. And who do we have in power at that time? Oh, that's right, Barry Obama, who loves big government, hates private enterprise, and of course was a Marxist Islamist at heart. So if you remember what TARP was, and I hope you're following me on this, TARP was the deal that was put together just as Bush was leaving and Obama was coming in, and it was like $715 or $750 billion, whatever it was, that the Treasury, the Federal Reserve, said they were going to pump into the banks to keep them solvent. Except it wasn't enough. So Obama cleverly, along with his alt-left Treasury folks, said, I'll tell you what, banks, I don't want to go back to Congress or the taxpayer for money. And if you don't get the money, you're going to go broke. So how about this? How about the United States government buys stock? We're going to buy preferred stock. Preferred stock, folks, is a stock interest. It's not like you buy out there in the stock market. Preferred stock is kind of like a loan with a warrant. In other words, you buy $1 million. I'm taking a number. You buy $1 million worth of preferred stock that carries a rate of 4%. You get your 4%, and you have the right to convert that preferred stock to common or whatever the deal happens to be with your investment. The United States government, folks, bought preferred stock in all of these big banks. Every single one. In fact, they bought so much preferred stock that when Obama came up with his brilliant idea, which was a step toward nationalizing these big banks, as I'll explain in a minute, his bright idea was, rather than us loaning you more money, how about you let us convert our preferred stock, which normally doesn't vote, to common stock, which, of course, as we all know, does vote in a corporation. And, of course, all the banks, desperate for money and really having no other place to turn, said okay. The result was is that the United States government, and most people don't know this, the United States government is the largest and or in some cases the controlling shareholder of virtually every one of the 19 too big to fail banks. Now you know where the term too big to fail comes from. You're too big to fail if the federal government owns 34 or 36% of your butt. Okay? Citigroup, for instance. There were other things that were involved in this too, and I just don't want to get in the weeds. It's just important that you know that under Obama, the preferred stock that came from TARP was converted to common stock. Without a vote of Congress, without informing Congress, gee, Obama never did that, right? He never did things behind, that's right, there was Iran, there was the IRS, the Hezbollah cocaine deal. Oh, I guess he did. Well, this is where he started, folks. So the United States government has stock interests in the 19 major banks in this country. And the only reason he didn't nationalize the banks... Let me find this quote for you. Quite interesting. I did a bunch of research to bring you this segment. Trust me. The quote was that the American public will not yet, will not yet condone the nationalization of their banks. That kind of gives you a hint as what the end game plan was, don't you think? Anyway, this is from an article, April 19th, 2009, by a gentleman by the name of Edmund L. Andrews, a high mucky muck in the finance world. He argues that converting the preferred stock and the loans to common shares also allowed Obama to stretch out. In other words, he didn't have to go back to Congress to bolster up the banks, because basically what he did was he turned an asset of the federal government, the preferred stock or the loan that was owing it by the big banks, into an asset of the banks, which increased their capital and took them off the going under list, if you can kind of follow what I'm saying. And they started off with Citicorp. And after Citicorp said yes, all the other banks did. Bank of America, for instance, followed Citicorp's lead. And the government did it in such a way that they had no choice. Zero. It was kind of like, this is a deal you can't refuse. Let me read you some quotes from Rahm Emanuel at that time, now the mayor of Chicago, right? A broke city and a broke state. Geez, you see all these characters come up at all the places that are broke. Makes you kind of wonder. So Rahm Emanuel at that time, when all this was going on, was on a Sunday show on the ABC program This Week. You can go back. I think you can dial up and you can watch it. And Emanuel, remember, this was not out in the public yet, what Obama was doing. This basically hostile takeover of the 19 largest banks in the country. Emanuel asserted on that show that suddenly the government, who had been saying they needed more money, Suddenly, they had enough money to shore up the 19 banks without asking for another dime from Congress. Quote, "We believe we have those resources available in the government as the final backstop to make sure that the 19 are financially viable and effective. If they need capital, we have that capacity," unquote. The next month, January, they came out with an announcement, quote, that it, the government, would alter its arrangements with Citigroup by converting up to $25 billion of preferred stock to common stock, which represents equity. As a sidelight, folks, just to give you an idea how huge these numbers are, after that conversion, the United States government owned 36% of Citicorp's stock, common shares, with full voting rights. That made the United States government Citicorp's biggest shareholder. So, you can kind of see how all this was coming down. You can kind of see the roots of it. You can see why it happened. You can see the compounding of errors as government literally tried to create money out of thin air and expand its control. And it's the same as California, New York, Illinois, Venezuela. It's the same exact pattern. And let me tell you that whenever this pattern is done, the results, give or take, are the same. It's like gravity, as I said before. Okay, let's switch to another article, because this is really the crux of the deal, which leads to the conclusion, which will shock you. I guarantee you it will shock you. So we have all these examples of governments, state governments, governments overseas, and it appears the United States government on the same course of creating money out of thin air, spending money they don't have, and spending the money on things which don't produce a return, that don't do anything for citizens but make them dependent and buy their vote. Now, to put in perspective the budget deal that was just done, because all this does is kind of accelerate stuff. The budget deal that was just done that everybody's clapping themselves on the shoulders on, other than Rand Paul, basically adds over $300 billion in spending over the next 2 years. $300 billion. Now, I have railed long and hard on this show. Type in unfunded liabilities. Type in primary debt. Type in anything like it. Type in budget deficit. You can listen to those shows and the interviews I did with national economists on them. This cannot continue. As part of this budget deal, the spending caps, by the way, a spending cap is not like you and I think about it as a spending cap, which is I spend $10 and tomorrow I'm only going to spend $9. Or even tomorrow I'm not going to spend any more than the $10 I spent today. A spending cap means a cap in the rise of the rate of spending. And the cap was 2% a year. That cap is now gone. The other thing that occurred with this bill is that the debt limit was abolished, basically. It was just thrown to the side. Where before there was a debt limit at which fiscal hawks and those that just want to spend your money could argue about whether or not to increase it, and at least you could hear something about it, it was just cast to the side. So we now have a government that's $20 trillion in debt, very little of it, by the way, under Mr. All these situations, with the exception of yesterday's budget deal, are not the doing of Trump. They're not even the doing of most of the people who are currently in Congress. So the budget deal is going to pump $300 billion more into the economy. It's going to increase our debt by $300 billion and our deficits up to about $1 trillion. It's highly likely that 2 years from now, our deficits will be up around $22 trillion from their current $20 trillion. Now, let me, what I do for you is connect dots. Now, if all this economy since 2008 has been fueled by funny money, i.e. the Fed buying its own debt and calling it money, and if that has fueled everything that's going on, and if the Fed, as we know it is, has now reversed that process, instead of pumping money into the economy by printing it out of thin air, basically, it's now taking money out of the economy. And if we know, as I'm sure the bigwigs in Washington and Trump for sure, if we know that China and other countries are going to retaliate economically, probably by buying less U.S. debt, which takes more money out of the economy, and if you're a politician and you want the economy to roll along, and if you're a politician like Trump, who I think sincerely believes we just might, in fact, maybe our only chance of getting out of this mess is to grow our way out of it. You don't want anything, you don't want money getting sucked out of the economy by countries that you're fighting with and by a Federal Reserve that suddenly reverse course. You want to keep that fiscal stimulus going. And how do you keep it going? If the Fed won't print money and buy bonds, and China won't buy bonds, how do you keep all this going? Well, you just saw it. You saw it in the budget deal. You keep it going by growing government and spending more money. Defense, domestic, whatever the plans are. So you understand that what's happening here is that the funny money of the Fed and the foreign investment money is going down, and the government is automatically increasing its expenditures to keep the same amount of money in the economy. Do you kind of get that? I mean, this is all part of a much bigger picture, folks. None of this stuff happens by itself. It's all interrelated. And one of the things that's going to happen as you get, rather than the Federal Reserve quantitative easing, i.e. buying, you know, boring Treasury debt and putting its own books using its own money, when you get the government starting to spend $150, $200 billion, whatever it's going to be, more per year, and that is a direct injection into the jugular of the economy in all sorts of ways. And money has a multiplier effect. Most economists think it's 16 to 1. So if you inject $200 million in 1 year into the jugular of the American economy, you're really creating 16 times that. In addition, you have the $2 trillion you expect back from companies due to the new tax law. In addition, you have everybody's tax savings, which, let's face it, folks, 99% of the people are going to spend rather than save. So you see, you're replacing one type of stimulus with another type of stimulus. But the end result of replacing, shall we say, fiscal policy with government policy is that government debt goes up rather than the balance sheet of the Fed increasing. You know, the Fed can increase its balance sheet and everybody can pretend like it has nothing to do with the government because the Fed is private, right? Yeah, right. Well, you and I both know it's all the same. But the Fed doesn't pay interest on its balance sheet. The Fed gets interest on its balance sheet because it holds Treasury securities. The government does pay interest on its debt because it's selling government securities and people are buying them and expecting a rate of return. And the only way you can finance all this stuff is to sell more government securities. I hope you're following me on this because it's important and you'll see where it goes, which is, it's a canary you need to know of, let's say that. I think the exact number, by the way, is $368 billion, give or take, in this new budget deal. Now, as the economy heats up, there's more and more people chasing fewer and fewer goods and services. There's more and more jobs with less and less people to fill them. And we're not talking illegal aliens, you lefties who listen to me, American citizens. and you start to have inflation. When you start to have inflation, lenders raise their interest rates because they got to get more interest than the rate of reflation, a rate of inflation, or they're losing money. I mean, if you're a lender and you're getting 1% and the inflation rate is 2%, the 1% in interest you're getting only buys 50% of what you need to buy because it all went up by 2%. Hopefully you follow. Well, look, as you increase the debt, the primary national, this doesn't even include the unfunded liabilities, folks, $120 trillion, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, government pensions, you name it. This is just the primary national debt. As you increase that debt because you've increased spending, because you've increased the budget, and you've increased the deficit, which has to be financed, the deficit has to be financed by debt, you're incurring more interest expense. At the same time that the stimulus you're providing to the economy is creating inflation, which means you're going to be paying more interest because interest rates are going to rise. And when interest rates rise and you are the United States or any other government paying interest on debt you have issued, your bonds, treasury bonds, that means that you have one of three things. You either have less money to spend on things that stimulate the economy, because let's face it, interest is a non-productive expenditure, right? Just like welfare, non-productive. You have nothing to show for it after you write that interest check. Just like you have nothing to show for it after you write the welfare check other than a vote at the next election. So that means the government is spending more and more on interest, which means, A, it either has to raise the amount of debt, it has to borrow to pay interest, right? Borrowing to pay interest. Or B, it has to raise money somehow, and we all know that there's only one source for the government's money. I've told you this many times. What is it? I'm listening. That's right, your pocket. The government is not a business, folks. It doesn't sell anything. It has one source of revenue, and that is your pocket or your assets. That is its only form of revenue. Now, to give you an idea how quickly this can compound, there was a terrific article, which I just happened to run across, but it was the best overview I've seen. According to TreasuryDirect.gov, you guys can go, all of you listeners can go look at this for yourself, TreasuryDirect.gov. The average interest rate paid on U.S. Treasury securities increased from 2.2% in November 2016 to 2.3% in December 2017. That doesn't sound like much, does it? Well, let me give you an idea of what happens when you are carrying the staggering and increasing loads of debt that we are. That 0.1% in the average interest rate means an additional $20.5 billion dollars in interest expense on our national debt. 0.1% equals $20.5 billion more interest expense. The revenues to the government, or actually the expenditures by the government, in the first 3 months of the fiscal year, remember, it begins in October for the government. The first 3 months, October, November, and December 2016, their interest expense increased to $147 billion from $139 billion last year. This is before interest rates really started to go up, folks. In December 2015, the average rate was 2.33%. December 2017, the average rate was 2.31%. The bonds, as you probably know, the treasuries are at about 2.7 or 2.8% as we speak. That's just in the last 6 weeks. That's how much they've increased. And we're talking about a net interest expense This is back before Obama really started to go crazy and added $10 billion. A net interest expense of $266 billion in 2017. There's another trick that the government plays. This is all going to a place that you need to hear. Trust me on this. And even if you only get part of this and you have to think about it, you have to listen to the show again, do replay. If you understand at least some of these underpinnings, you'll understand where we end up and where you end up and where your deposits end up. That's right. The cash that you think is yours that you have in the banks, particularly, I'm not talking about the community banks now and the strong regional banks. That's where you need to be. But if you have money in the 19 big banks, I want you to listen hard to me. Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Chase, Citicorp, any of those. I think you'll know what you need to do after you're done listening to this show. You'd much rather deal with your local banker in the future, not Citicorp in New York, as you will see. The government divides its debt, by the way, once again, plays hide the ball, into two categories, public debt, okay, and then intergovernmental holdings. Public debt is $14.7 billion at the end of 2017. The rest of that $20 trillion is what the government likes to call intergovernmental holdings. Now, you go, well, what are I've never heard of that. What are intergovernmental holdings? Well, folks, intergovernmental holdings, let me give you an example. It's the money that the government has borrowed from the Social Security Trust Fund, which began back in the days of Bill Clinton. That is how they balanced the budget, folks. They never really balanced the budget. Clinton couldn't even tell you the truth about that. The only way they balanced the budget was to borrow $250 billion, give or take, from the Social Security Trust Fund to balance the budget. Which, as we both know, all of you out there listening to me, we're just bubbas, you know, we're deplorables, we're ignorant, we're all this kind of stuff. But we do know that if you borrow from the left hand and put it in the right hand's pocket and then say that your right pocket is balanced, you are in imbalance, right? You have created nothing. You simply move the quarter from one side to the other, it's still a quarter. And you still owe it. So that's some games that they play. $458 billion interest expense means, and that was in the year 2017 with interest rates really low. That tells us that about $200 billion is being spent by the United States government on intergovernmental debt. I want you to think about that for a minute. $200 billion is being spent in interest by the government to basically pay another agency of the government interest for money the operating arm of the government has borrowed from the other entity, like the Social Security Trust Fund. The same, by the way, is true with the FDIC and Medicare. It's all the same. It's going on everywhere throughout the government. It's how they are balancing the books. Nothing to do with Trump. This started long before him. In fact, it really kind of started with Bill Clinton. Can you imagine if Hillary was president right now? Oh my God. Now, the bulk of that interest, by the way, most analysts feel go to Social Security, where they've robbed the trust fund. According to I'm reading right out of this article. Quote, according to Social Security report, July 2017, of the $836 billion in benefits paid in 2017, an additional $88 billion came from earned interest. Thus, 10% of Social Security payouts last year came from a large percentage of interest earned on the Social Security portion of the intergovernmental holdings, i.e., the rape, pillage, and borrowing by the operating arm of the government from the trust fund arm of the government. Your trust fund, I might add. Remember, this is your trust fund. This is your government borrowing from your trust fund to buy their votes. You got to love it. Now, once again, I'm not going to get wonkish in all this stuff, but this is happening throughout the Western world. All the central banks, the Federal Reserves of all the other countries have been doing the same thing for the last 10 years. The governments of all these countries have been doing the same thing, i.e. borrowing from their, whatever they call it, their version of Social Security. And all of them are facing rising interest costs, spiraling deficits, increasing budget busts, and all of them have the same source of revenue as the United States government, the only source of revenue, and that is your pocket. The other thing that has happened is that the banks, the 19 big banks, in which the same government that is borrowing from its own trust funds to fund its non-productive operations, that same government owns the majority of stock, or at least the largest block of stock, in these 19 biggest banks. So it should be no surprise to you that the government is always out for itself. And it should be no surprise to you that the big banks are always out for themselves. And if you put the two together so that they come up with an arrangement that scratches each of their backs at your expense, since they are always out for themselves, and they've both dug a hole from which they cannot escape without your assistance, you will not be surprised at what's been agreed, what is the law, and where this is kind of going. Let me go to an article, March 29th, 2013. It was under Washington's blog. It was also, there was another article on the webofdebt.com. It's called Bank Confiscation Scheme for U.S. and U.K. Depositors. This was right after Cyprus, if you remember the stories back then. This is almost, what, 5-6 years ago now. Cyprus got in a world of hurt exactly because of the same pattern that I've been telling you about here. Cyprus was Venezuela, so to speak. And Cyprus nationalized the deposits of folks who had money in Cyprus banks. They tried to mask it by saying it was mostly international depositors. They masked it by saying it was an appropriate tax on the wealthy. They conjured all sorts of stuff up, just like the alt-left does, particularly when they're covering their ass. I'm quoting now. A joint paper by the U.S. Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and the Bank of England, dated December 10th, 2012, which originated with the G20 Financial Stability Board in Basel, Switzerland, came up with, I quote, "The national government is pushing a Cyprus-style solution to bank failure, which will see small depositors lose some of their savings to fund big bank bailouts." I want you to think about that for a moment. A Cyprus-style solution to bank failure, which will see small depositors lose some of their savings to fund big bank bailouts. By the way, folks, this whole scam has become known as the bail-in. You know, you had the bail-out, now you have the bail-in. And what this really does, and I'm going to refer you to that 15-page FDIC Bank of England document. It is called Resolving Globally Active Systemically Important Financial Institutions. Put it in Google. Read it for yourself. That paper, by the way, begins by explaining that the 2008 banking crisis, this is why I gave you this foundation, made it clear, quote, "Some other way besides taxpayer bailouts is needed to maintain financial stability." Yeah, you bet. Let me quote some more. This is from the paper. "An efficient path for returning the sound operations of GSIFI and that is, we'll call it the big banks. How's that? To the private sector would be provided by exchanging or converting a sufficient amount of the unsecured debt from the original creditors of the failed company, i.e. the depositors, folks, into equity or stock. In the United States, the new equity would become capital in one or more newly formed operating entities. In the UK, the same approach could be used, or the equity could be used to recapitalize the failing financial company itself. Thus, the highest layer of surviving bailed-in creditors, you understand where the bail-in term comes from now? Your deposits become stock. You've bailed in. Now, you didn't get to approve it, but you've bailed in. Of the bailed-in creditors would become the owners of the resolved firm. In either country, the new equity holders, that's you, you used to have a deposit, now you got stock in the bank. The new equity holders would take on the corresponding risk of being shareholders in a financial institution. Let me kind of boil this down for you. Although virtually no one realizes it. And by the way, once again, I'm not talking about strong community and regional banks. They are your friends. They're still banks. You're still the borrower. They still got their rights, etc. But people who recognize you, people who know your business, the banks that is down on Main Street is a different animal. And in fact, have formed their own banking association, Community Bankers Association. They broke away from the ABA, which is all the big banks, run by the 19 too-big-to-fail crooks. This is where you want to have your money, folks. You want to be in your solvent and strong community, local, and regional banks. In my opinion, you don't want to have a single penny in or anything to do with any of the 19 biggest banks in this country, like Wells Fargo, Chase Manhattan, JP Morgan, blah, 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 Citicorp, you name it. You want to run like hell. Because in those banks, unlike your small local banks, which have all sorts of other benefits and also help your own community rather than some outfit in New York, in those outfits, you have an insurmountable problem. You have a bank that has your money, that's now their money, for which they owe you an IOU. And you have a bank whose largest shareholder is the United States government. In other words, you have two desperate entities holding what you thought was your money. And trust me, they will do anything they have to do with your money to make their day. To boil it down, legally, this is the law. The bank owns the depositor's funds. As soon as you deposit them in your checking account or your savings account or your money market or your CD or whatever you have. So your money is the bank's money at that second that you make the deposit. And you become, under law, an unsecured creditor. The only thing you have is your bank statement, the IOU of the bank to you. So far, the banks have been obligated to pay the money back on demand, in the form of cash if you want it. But as we all know, that's getting more and more. I mean, you've all had that experience. However, under the FDIC BOE plan, those IOUs, if the bank gets into trouble, in other words, it starts to go under, those IOUs, which you think are your deposits, the bank can convert to its stock, thereby taking a loan to you and making an asset of theirs. And what you have to show for it is a share of stock. So, as crazy as that sounds, them's the facts, Jack. Now, if you don't think that the government hasn't thought this through, and if you don't think that the big banks, the too big to fail banks, that the government is the largest owner in, hasn't thought this through, we're now at the point where, and I'm quoting, There is no exception indicated for insured deposits in the United States, meaning those under $250,000. The deposits we thought were protected by FDIC insurance. This can hardly be an oversight, since it is the FDIC that is issuing the directive. Don't you like it? That's kind of like the FBI investigating itself, isn't it? It's all kind of the same, is it not? This directive is called a resolution process, defined elsewhere as a plan that would be triggered in the event of the failure of an insurer. FDIC, bank, government, you may. The only mention of insured deposits is in connection with the existing United Kingdom legislation, which the FDIC BOE directive goes on to say is inadequate and should be modified or overridden. So there's a double whammy here. What they're really saying here, let me boil this down to you. So a bank starts to go under. The money you thought you had in the bank, which is really IOUs the bank owes you under law, is converted without your knowledge, consent, or anything else into bank stock. You have no more money, you have stock. And the FDIC is saying that once it's converted into stock, you'll love this. Remember, you're dealing with the bank that's saving its butt and the government who's a shareholder in the bank that's also saving its butt. The FDIC directive that I was just referencing says that once it's stock, they no longer insure it because it's not a deposit. So your stock, your money has been converted to stock, and the stock is no longer insured. Whew. Who wins in this game? Oh, it must be the government and the big bank. I quote, this is from Yves, that's Y-V-E-S, Smith. This is from March 19th. When you weren't looking, Democrat bank stooges launched bills to permit bailouts and deregulate derivatives. There's those derivatives again, right? These big banks have huge derivative risks. In the U.S., I'm quoting from the article, in the U.S., depositors have actually been put in a worse position than Cyprus deposit holders, at least if they are at the big banks that play in the derivatives casino. Remember what I told you? You don't want to be with the big banks, folks. The regulators have turned a blind eye, and the regulators are who, folks? Oh, it's the government, who's the largest shareholder in the big banks. I see how this works. Have turned a blind eye as banks use their depositaries to fund derivative exposures. And as bad as that is, the depositors, unlike their Cypriot confreres, aren't even senior creditors. Remember Lehman? What was I telling you, folks? Lehman Brothers, beginning of the financial crisis of 08 and 09, derivatives. Remember Lehman? When that investment bank failed, unsecured creditors, and remember, depositors are deemed to be unsecured creditors, got 8 cents on the dollar. One big reason was that derivative counterparties require collateral for any exposure, meaning they are secured creditors. The 2005 bankruptcy reforms made derivative counterparties senior to unsecured lenders. Let me boil this down for you. So all these big banks have derivatives. They have huge risk. Those derivatives are collateral for loans and whatever they have to them. Something goes wrong, somebody else steps in, like maybe the government, and takes those derivatives. In other words, forecloses like overnight on the collateral. It's like foreclosing your home, but it happens in the blink of an eye while you're asleep. The bank then doesn't have assets. That means its capital is deficient. That means it's insolvent. That means it can now, under these directives, don't you love the circle here? It can now, because the government has taken back its collateral, or whoever, and made the bank insolvent, the bank can now take your deposits and make it stock so the bank is no longer insolvent. I want you to think about that for a moment, folks. Now, would you rather be dealing with your friend, your neighbor, your community member down at your community, local, or regional bank or credit union? Or would you rather be reading about this in the Wall Street Journal while you're puking up your breakfast some Monday? Now do you understand the story I told you at the beginning of the show? All right. By the way, just to really hammer this home, the derivatives which blew up the market, the big banks, back in 08, were in the hundreds of billions. They had hundreds of billions of these really risky derivatives. Let me tell you what they have now, and this will really catch your attention. J.P. Morgan Chase, their deposit-taking entity, that's Chase Manhattan Bank. You know, because all these big banks have like all sorts of tentacles. But the tentacle of J.P. Morgan, which takes your deposits if you are foolish enough to bank with Chase Manhattan, okay, which is J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, N.A., owns 99% of J.P. Morgan's $79 trillion. Let me say that again. $1 trillion of notional derivatives. This is, by the way, from the OCC, which is the regulatory agency of the government. Oh, the government, the stockholder, which oversees these things. Bank of America's holding company, here's another big one of the 19, holds almost $75 trillion of derivatives at the end of June. You know, whoo, my. Now, to put that in perspective, the United States economy is about $19 trillion. In fact, those two banks alone hold more notional derivatives, 75 and 79 trillion, it's 160 trillion, whatever, just those two, than the entire GDP of the entire planet, folks. Okay. I think you kind of got where I'm going with this. And trust me, you will hear, if this happens, or in the case of the big banks, maybe when it happens, you will hear all sorts of nonsense. It's fair, it's equitable, it's social justice, you know, all that crap that we hear from the left. It's a tax on the wealthy. You know, it's the only right thing to do. This is so much crud. Now, I'm not telling you what to do. I'm not even suggesting you what to do. But I will tell you that if I have one dime in the world, it will not be at those 19 banks. If I have a car loan, it will not be with one of those banks. If I have a mortgage loan, it will not be with one of those banks. Now, that's just me. You have to make your decision. But one of the things you might want to do, if you are banking with any of those 19 entities, is you might want to make it a point between now and the next On the Right Side radio show to go down and shake hands with your local community, regional, credit union, or community banker and have a cup of coffee with them. Just saying. All right. There's more I could say on this, but I think you kind of got it. I think on one hand, you have seen the scary and complete corruption. Not complete. That's not fair. The upper level complete corruption of the FBI, the DOJ. You're about to find out about the State Department and a bunch of other people. You've seen the incompetence and the weaponizing of the IRS, the EPA, and God knows what else by the government. The government is, in the end, people, folks, who react like people. They just happen to have the power of the government behind them. And knowing what you are knowing, what is now coming into light, thanks to Mr. Trump, about your government, until it's cleaned up, which I think the process has begun, and knowing what you know now, in that the government has very large stakes in the 19 largest banks, and the banks and those banks have huge derivative exposure, and that what on one hand the shareholder can, to make it really simple, can take the assets of the bank, making the bank insolvent, and it in turn can take your cash, your assets, your deposits, to make itself solvent and give you stock, which the government will then no longer insure because it's not cash. I think you kind of see where this is all going, or where it could go. Now, you remember that all-American couple I told you the, hopefully, make-believe story at the beginning of this show? If you notice, I didn't have a conclusion on that story. Do you know why? Because a conclusion on that story, which is your story, is up to you. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Got a barn burner of a show for you next week. I think I'm finally going to get to that, you know, Google, Facebook, Yahoo, you name it, trying to screw with the information you're getting more and more, trying to ram their leftist stuff down your throat without you knowing. And depending upon what blows up this week, and I'm sure there'll be a bunch, hopefully we'll get to that story next week. My pleasure to bring this to you. And I sincerely hope that it makes a difference for you and your family, or at least gets you thinking about steps you can take that could make a difference for you and your family. We're all Americans, and this is the good old USA. MAGA.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.